Okay, we can start. Welcome back from the break, everybody. First thing is, those of you in the back of the room, can you hear me okay? I don't know what the acoustics is like in this room, because I could always turn up the microphone. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay, good. If you ever have trouble with the sound, just let me know. I'm kind of like an old car, you know, that kind of runs out of steam a little bit, so sometimes I lose my voice. What? You're right. All right, this is PoliSci 138B, which is a course on international politics in the 20th century. We're going to start the course with the origins of the First World War and continue to the end of the Cold War, basically. What I'm going to do today, two things. First thing is I want to kind of give you a sense for what the course is going to be about, the kind of questions we're going to cover, like the basic philosophy of the course, what we're trying to do in this course. That's number one. And number two is I want to kind of cover the nuts and bolts, which they're basically laid out in the syllabus, but I'll go through them again. And if you have any questions about the mechanics of the course or questions about anything, we could talk about that. I don't think we're going to be taking up the full 50 minutes today. At least I hope not, because I want to end a little bit early. Because those of you who are not officially enrolled, I'll be able to give you PTE numbers at the end of the class, and I want to make sure that there's enough time for that before you have to get to your next class. Okay. What's our goal in this class? We're concerned in this class with the most basic questions, the questions that define the whole field of international relations, right? That dominate that whole area of inquiry. This is the question of war and peace. What makes for war? Or the other side of that coin is, or what makes for a stable international system? And if you believe that it's of fundamental importance, especially in the nuclear age, to avoid war, the answer you get to that question of what makes for war is of fundamental policy importance. Because if you want to avoid war, you have to figure out what causes it. And so we're also going to be concerned to a certain degree with the question of what makes for good foreign policy. Are there any principles of a general nature that you could point to that go beyond what's kind of obvious that should guide foreign policy? All right. The two great questions. Is there anything of a general nature that you could say about that issue of war and peace, about that answers to that question of what makes for war? Is there anything, you know, because you come in with a set of general beliefs that you absorb from the larger culture about that question, what makes for war? Is that door locked? Was that door locked?
Yeah.
Could you just stick that thing there so in case anyone else comes in? I must say, how could they have the door locked for a classroom, the main door into a classroom the first day of classes? See, things like that are very upsetting to me because I have a basically rationalist approach to the way the world works. And whenever I see stuff like that, I just, all right. you absorb a certain general set of views about what makes for war from the general culture. And the measure of insight that you develop by studying these issues is whether views that you develop are at variance with those views in the general culture. What are those general views? Oh, it's very simple. You want to understand the causes of war? It's basically, you want to figure out who's to blame. Who's the guilty party? Who's responsible for it? Origins of the First World War? Very, very simple question. You know, who caused it? Who started it? You know? The great debate on the origins of the First World War still continues to the present day. You know, this is, I guess 2015 now. In 2014 was the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. A lot of books came out and so on. You can see that this issue is very much a live political issue. Is Germany to blame? You know, what caused it? Right? So in the popular culture, the larger culture, you know, there's this whole notion of war. You know, want to figure out the origins of the war. Who's responsible? Or the Second World War in Europe. Yeah. What caused it? Very, very simple. One word answer. Hitler. Hitler caused the Second World War. That's what people believe. In the war in the Pacific, Japan. One word answer. You know, these countries are aggressive countries. Aggression causes wars. Most countries are want to live in peace. So if you have a war, it has to do to the aggressiveness of one side or the other. In other words, it's a moral theory of war. Emphasizes moral factors. You look at the early literature on the origins of the Second World War, it's Hitler's evil on the one hand, the cravenness, the moral weakness of the West, you know, symbolized by the policy of appeasement, a moral theory of war. You say, well, is there any alternative to that? Same thing about the Cold War. How do you understand the Cold War? Well, who's to blame? Is the Russians to blame? Well, during the period of the Vietnam War, there was a reaction to this whole traditionalist notion that the Soviets were to blame for the Cold War. And people say, oh, no, it's not the Soviets that are to blame. America's to blame. America's kind of this evil imperialist country. America's responsible for all this stuff. But it's still a moral view. You know, who's to blame? And the question is that an adequate framework for approaching these issues, because you know it's important to realize that there's another whole other approach. Okay. A body of thought developed over the years, international relations thought, international relations theory, international relations scholarship. As people grappled with that issue and tried to come up with alternate ways of looking at things. Well, maybe, you know, wars aren't just started by evil aggressors. Maybe, you know, the whole process leading to a war is more subtle. That maybe no one's responsible. Maybe everyone's behavior is conditioned by the kind of environment in which they find themselves. The system, the structure of the system, is what pushes countries into conflict with each other. Body of thought. Now, what's the importance of that body of thought for our purposes? Is it important simply because it gives you ready-made answers to these fundamental questions of what makes for war, what makes for good policy, and so on? No. It's important not because it gives you the answers, but rather because it defines the questions that we want to answer. Theory is important because it's like this searchlight that we can use to shine into the massive body of evidence, and it kind of throws into relief, gets you to see what's really important, which will help you make up your own mind for yourselves about how you're going to answer those questions. You know, it brings out the importance of the evidence, because these answers turn on the evidence. But you can't just approach the evidence in this kind of mindless way. You can't just approach it cold. There's this huge, vast ocean of evidence, bearing on all these questions. You know, countries, the governments keep records, meetings and correspondence and so on. These records are secret for many years. You know, like 20, 30, 40 years later, they become available. Historians can kind of get a feel for what people were thinking at the time. There's all sorts of stuff that was on the public record. But it's massive. And in order to kind of draw meaning from this huge ocean of material, you have to have a body of theories, a body of theory which defines questions, which will tell you what's important in the evidence, because you want the evidence to kind of speak to those issues, and you can't just do it in a mindless way. Now, that's the basic philosophy of this course. It's not, you know, I'm a historian by training. I'm teaching in a political science department. This is a hybrid course. It's not a history course in the usual sense, and it's not a political science course in the usual sense either. My personal feeling is you can grapple with these issues on a theoretical level, high level of abstraction. A lot of that analysis is interesting, but it can only take you so far. And beyond a certain point, you're just spinning out ideas, no matter how interesting those ideas are, you're just spinning them out of your own head. There's a limit to how much value that sort of thing can have. On the other hand, this whole kind of just the facts, ma'am, sort of approach, you know, just one fact after another, this happened, then that happened, then that happened. It's kind of just a pure empirical approach. That doesn't tell you very much either. You're exposed to all these facts, and you say to yourself, what do they mean? How do you draw meaning out of that set of facts? The key to insight in this area of scholarship, as well as in so many others, is finding some way to get the conceptual side and the empirical side to kind of connect with each other. And so that's what we're going to do. That's going to be like the structure of the lectures. It's like we're going to begin with kind of the basic conceptual issues, questions. And then we're going to look at the empirical evidence with an eye to seeing what light they throw on these great conceptual problems, the problem of what makes for war, what makes for a stable international system, what makes for a good foreign policy. Yeah? Okay. Let me stress that point about policy. You're all citizens of a very powerful country. When you vote in elections, it's in part with an eye to, what sort of foreign policy the country would pursue. Policy issues are really important. How do you form opinions about whether there are fundamental guidelines that should govern the conduct of foreign policy? Right. Well, one important way to do it is to take different frameworks for approaching policy and see how well they worked in the past. In other words, the historical material provides us with a kind of laboratory for thinking about policy issues. Because in general, like I was saying before, there's a limit to how far you can go when you approach these issues at a purely abstract level. You've got to bring them down to earth. You got, in order for your thinking to come alive, it has to be in some sort of real context. You know, so much of theoretical work is very abstract and is devoid of a reality quality. You want to bring it down to earth and give it a reality quality by thinking through these issues in specific historical contexts. All right? So, you know, again, it's this basic point. You want to avoid these twin problems of kind of mindless empiricism where it's just this massive material that doesn't really have any meaning. And on the other hand, this kind of empty, abstract conceptualization. You want to get those two things to connect. So that's going to be what we the way we're kind of going to approach these issues in this course. Okay. So one of our main goals is the substantive goal of getting insight into this whole question of how international politics works, what makes for war, what makes for peace. But we're also interested, to my mind, this is probably the most important thing that I want people to kind of get out of this class. The most important thing is methodological in nature, not substantive, but methodological. How do you go about making up your mind for yourself? There's a big difference between high school and college. Just look at the structure of this room. I mean, here I am, up on this podium, just spouting off, and there you are, just like sponges absorbing what I say. People have their computers out or pads and taking down these things as notes. I call that the sponge theory of learning. The whole idea is a whole lot of stuff gets dished out to you and we absorb it, and that's what learning is. Very bad, very wrong. That's not the way things should work. Real learning has to be active. You have to be prodded into, thinking these issues out for yourself. You have to be provided with a method for reaching your own conclusions about these issues, right? You want to a method that'll put you in the driver's seat and help you make up your own minds about these issues. Okay? These issues, where you approach lots of issues. And what is that method? The method is not approaching the material in a very direct way, but rather in an indirect way, reacting to what scholars have had to say. Right? Scholars make various arguments, sometimes very general arguments, sometimes specific arguments about particular historical episodes. You hold up those arguments and you look at those claims in the light of the evidence, also in the light of the internal logic of the author's arguments, because a lot of people say things that are internally contradictory. You look at the evidence in light of all these historical interpretations, these international relations theories, and you say, what's valid? Okay. But to do that, you first have to learn how to identify what is distinctive about a particular interpretation or about a particular historical argument. These historical texts, they're not just big compendia of facts. They're not encyclopedias that just dish out to you a whole lot of facts. These historical texts, theoretical texts as well, they're making an argument. The author wants to convince you of something. You want to first identify what that argument is, what the author wants to convince you of. Right? And then once you identify what the main thesis of a book or an article is, then you want to look and see how the author goes about demonstrating that. How the author tries to convince you that that fundamental thesis is in fact correct. So you look at the key sub-arguments that support that larger claim. And then you look at those sub-arguments closely with a view to seeing how much evidence supports them. Does the author really provide you with sufficient evidence to convince you that those specific claims is correct or are correct? Right? That's the basic method. And that's a method that I really want you to kind of master in the course of the quarter. And big component of the two exams is designed to test how well you're able at least to go the first step, which is to identify an argument. Now, how do you identify an argument in any of the texts that we're reading? Well, it turns out that there are certain key places that you want to look. The author doesn't want to hide this stuff, since given that the author's goal is to convince you of something, that point is going to be made in a very clear way. For example, it can be embodied in the title of the book or article. That's the first place you want to look. You look at the title and you think, gee, is there a claim here, or is there an implicit question here? For example, we have a couple of books we're going to read this quarter. One is by A.J. P. Taylor called The Origins of the Second World War. Well, that title is in effect a promise to you. He's promising you, I'm going to tell you what caused the Second World War. Right? And so right away, your antennae should be activated, right? Radar screen should be turned on. Okay. All right. You got to ask yourself as you read that book, how does he answer that question? How does he explain the coming of the Second World War? Right. Similarly, another book we're reading is by a guy named Jonathan Utley, and it's called Going to War with Japan. Again, how does he explain why the United States went to war with Japan? The title is a promise. It tells you what you want to look for as you read the book. What else do you want to look at? Table of contents. Very important because you approach the chapter titles in much the same way. Is there a message in the chapter titles? Is there an overall architecture to the book, a structure to an argument? The introduction, the conclusion, the first and last paragraph in the book or article as a whole, the first and last paragraph in each chapter or in each section, you know, first and last sentence in the book as a whole. Those are the places where an author is going to be tipping his or her hand. You read those things really carefully with those questions in mind. What is the fundamental thesis here? And then once you identify the thesis by looking in those key places, then you say, well, how does the author go about proving this, right? So what this means is you can zip through a big part of the text very quickly, because a lot of what you find in a book is just kind of padding from the standpoint of the fundamental argument. But the things that do bear on the fundamental argument, those things you're going to read carefully with a view to seeing, you know, how those questions should be answered. Now, all this stuff is very abstract. And so I kind of decided that one of the things I'm going to have people read this quarter is a thing I wrote for a methods book I wrote about. It's a chapter from the methods book that shows you how this method works in practice, how you can use this method to hammer out an interpretation that you feel comfortable with. In other words, throwing open the doors of the workshop and allowing people to see how an interpretation gets worked out, how we go about, you know, analyzing text and using the results of that analysis to define questions that we pose to the evidence with a view to answering these substantive issues about how we ended up in a war. Right? So this is the a chapter about America's road to war in 1941. So this is one of the things I'm going to give you. So we'll be talking about this in just a minute. Okay, how are we doing? So the method is important. It provides you with a very time-effective way of sinking your teeth into the most basic problems that you're concerned with, a method that will allow you as individuals to reach conclusions on your own. In other words, you're not expected to simply, you know, absorb everything that I'm saying and to kind of rehash my arguments back in the exam. I don't care about that. What's important is that you deal with these issues honestly yourself, and that you use this course as kind of an opportunity to kind of grapple with those fundamental issues about, you know, war and peace and foreign and military policy. Another thing I'm going to be doing this quarter is, because this method is new to you, practically everyone in the class, it's new to you, because you've just kind of been programmed from practically the first day you set foot in kindergarten to believe what the teacher tells you, or to believe what you read in the texts that are assigned to you. And this is like telling you, no, you got to be skeptical of all those things. You got to, you know, instead of being passive like that, you got to approach these things in a much more active way and try and set things up so you can make your mind up for yourself. Right? I'm doing another thing. I'm going to have a whole class devoted to one of the books we're reading this quarter. This is this book by A.J. P. Taylor called The Origins of the Second World War. So I'm asking people to bring their copy of the book to a class that day. All the stuff is noted on the syllabus, as you may have seen. But we will go through the Taylor book in detail to show you how this method works in practice, how you identify the central thesis of the book, how you see the key arguments that support that general thesis, how you then analyze those key arguments in the light of the evidence that Taylor himself presents, including evidence that basically cuts against those key arguments. It's a nice little exercise that will help you see how this method works in practice. Right? Okay. So that's pretty much it in terms of the general philosophy of the course, you know, giving you a feel for what this course is going to be like. Now I'm going to switch and talk a little bit about nuts and bolts issues. I guess I'll just look at the syllabus. This quarter, two exams, a midterm on February 6th, I think. Is that what it is? Yeah. Midterm on February 6th covers the first part of the course, which is from the origins of the First World War down to the origins of America's involvement in the Second World War in December of 1941. Right? Now, in terms of readings, it's through the Utley book. And then the final exam will be held on March 13th, which is the last day of classes. Both of these exams will have the same format. Your grade will be determined pretty much 50-50 on the basis of how well you're doing those two exams. They'll have the same format. Basically, kind of a factual sort of format. You either know it or you don't. Short answer questions, you know, two or three sentences for an answer. Nothing really tricky, nothing really obscure, but the kind of things that you probably didn't know before you didn't take this course. Characterizing a particular policy. Those kind of questions, and the other questions will deal with the readings. And I'm not going to ask you to criticize the readings or give your own opinions about things, but rather simply to define what the central argument of a particular text is using the method that I just explained to you in general terms, which we're going to, you know, get at in more detail when we deal with the Taylor book in class. Okay? The idea here is, I don't like essay questions. You know, why is it? Because they're very hard to grade. Because people can just BS their way through an essay question, and it's very hard to give a really bad grade. And on the other hand, in an essay question in a class, it's hard to do really kind of a brilliant job. So, you know, no one can really get, you know, a legitimate A+ or anything like that. So everyone is kind of pushed together in this kind of middle, and the judgments become much more subjective. But if you're asked simply to identify what a central argument of a book is, And if you're asked, for example, a question about that Taylor book, and you say, according to H.A.P. Taylor, the Second World War is to be attributed almost entirely to Nazi aggressiveness. Well, I know you haven't read the book. You haven't. It's like, and your ability to identify an argument is also correlated with your ability to grasp seriously with the issues raised in that argument. Your understanding of specific factual things, it's not simply a question of learning a lot of factual material by rote. This material, it sticks in your mind if you've been approaching these things at a conceptual level. Because that gives you a framework that the factual points could kind of latch onto in your brain. So by testing your factual command, we're in effect testing these things that it's correlated with, which is to say, you know, the degree to which you're grappling with these problems on a more abstract, more general, more theoretical level. Right? So it's indirect. What else? Oh, yeah. See this thing here? This microphone? That means that this lecture and other lectures are being recorded automatically. Did you have a question? Oh. And are going to be available on Bruincast. So in the syllabus, you have the link for Bruincast. Let me talk about the course website. That's the course website. Everyone should know how to get to it through Moodle. If you don't, the URL is up there in the top left. The syllabus is on the course website. Okay? The syllabus has a link to the Bruincast. If you have problems with the Bruincast, get in touch with them directly because I'm like the least technical person in the world, pretty much. So I couldn't answer your question even if you asked me. But the fact that these lectures are available on Bruincast, I have to tell you, I have mixed feelings about it. You know why? Because you put stuff on Bruincast, and that means that a lot of people say, I don't have to go to class. And you'll see. I probably even beginning on Wednesday. You see how many people are in the class now? Remember that practically every seat in the classroom is filled up now? About, maybe one, if we get one-third of the attendance on Wednesday, I'd kind of be amazed. Because that's the way Bruincast works. And in a sense, I could kind of understand it. I mean, at UCLA, it's hard for a lot of people. A lot of people can't afford to live in Westwood, you know? I have to say, I was kind of amazed when I started teaching here 15 years ago that so many students have to kind of live at home and commute for maybe, you know, an hour each way. Well, an hour each way, you know, that's time to listen to a 50-minute lecture when you drive it in. So we kind of bend a little bit. You know, it's not ideal. It's much better if you kind of come to class because there's something magical about a class. You know, you can see my body language and you sense the feeling on the part of the other students that people are a little confused. You can see it in their faces. Another thing is, I really like it when people interrupt and ask questions. Okay, because you know why? Because with me just kind of talking and droning on and on, you know, people kind of tend to fall asleep and so on. But if you ask questions, then people perk up and pay much more attention, right? So there's no shame to asking questions. No one's ever going to ridicule you for asking a stupid question, right? But the problem with that is Bruincast is not going to capture those questions. So you're going to miss out on that as well. Another thing is Bruincast doesn't always work. Sometimes the batteries go dead in the middle of the lecture. And in those cases, I have the Bruincast from previous quarters, and I'll try and give you the appropriate replacement lecture, but even so, it's nice to kind of come to class. That being said, you know, let's be realistic about this. what else? You'll see on the website here, there's a link for class outlines. Every class I'm going to project on the screen an outline for the lecture. So you can kind of follow along. You see that there's a kind of structure to what we're doing. If you're listening to this stuff at home, you'll have the outline of the lecture. It could help you kind of follow what's being said. What else? Books, they've all been ordered. They should be available at the UCLA store. Has anyone gone over there yet? Yeah, are they there?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, terrific. And also, there's a course pack available down on campus copies there on, is that what it's called? Wayburn copies? Campus copies? I forget the name. Wayburn Copy Center, Westwood Copy Center on Daly, just below Wayburn. This has most of the readings other than the books that have been assigned. There's one exception that I forgot to put in the course pack this quarter, but it is on the course website, and it's the chapter on America's Road to War in 1941 that I was talking about before. But it is available on the course website, I think, I don't know, week four or something like that. And you could just read it online, or you can download it and print it out, whatever you like. What else? On the course website, in addition to some of the material that's in the course pack, I also posted a couple of the things on the website. There's a lot of stuff that's just kind of recommended or interesting things to read. If you just click into the links for the various weeks, you'll see what all this stuff is. Some of these things are like recordings and fun things to a certain extent. Plus interesting articles that kind of support some of the key points that are developed in the lectures, just kind of give you a feel for what the best scholarship is interested in, how the best scholarship has a kind of a point to it, and those points have all kinds of broad implications about how international politics works, what makes for war. So if you're interested in this stuff, and I know at least some people are taking this course because they're interested in 20th century international politics. You may want to kind of take a look at those recommended things. I'll be alluding to them in the lectures as well. What else? Get in touch with me. I have office hours Tuesday 3 to 5 at 3258 Bunch Hall. All this is noted there. If you can't make those office hours, you can always grab me right after class. I'm requesting that people just use email very sparingly because, as you all know, there's a limit to how good email is and as an effective conveyor of information. Let's see. One last point before we break up is, so I mentioned this at the beginning, but I also put a statement on the course website about enrollment. Is anyone who's in this classroom today who's not enrolled, I'm going to give a PTE number to, right? But it's just today. If people are listening to this online and they didn't come to class today, don't come and ask me for a PTE number, on Wednesday or on Friday, because that's it. Where the class is, in theory, it's full to the brim. We already have 175 people enrolled, and this classroom holds 175 people. So I'm not really supposed to admit more people into the class than the classroom can hold, because where are people going to sit during exams? But we all know people sign up for classes. A lot of people are shopping. They don't quite know whether they really want to take something or not. We always have a certain fall off from the enrollment before classes begin to what it's going to be in a week or two. So we're kind of taking that into account by letting other people come in. Okay, so before we break and people come up for their PTE numbers, let me ask you whether you guys have any questions for me? Nothing at all? Is that, yes?
There is an enormous amount of reading. Would you be guiding us as to what things that are absolutely essential?
There's not an enormous amount of reading. This is quite doable. What I do want to do is get you to understand that there's a way to read, so that you can read this stuff efficiently. That a lot of it that's not relevant, you could skim, but you focus in very intensely on the important parts of the text. Anything else? Yeah? Sit down. We still have another 10 minutes. Yeah? What will be real? Let me see what it is, and if you want, I could put it on. Okay, it's just my article. Yeah, I'll put that on the website if it's not already there. I'll make a point of that. Okay, because that way you don't have to buy the course back until you're really sure of the course. Is that the idea? Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, thanks for saying that. Anything else? Yes. Yes, I am. She asked, am I having office hours tomorrow? Yeah, of course. It's the quarter has begun. Office hours are sacrosanct. Anything else? Okay, PT numbers, you don't have to rush up or anything. Everyone will get one.